It's Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine joins us for a look at some recent studies challenging the timeline of human evolution.
First, we're getting an update on the state budget situation. There's been a lot of back and forth between the two Republican caucuses at odds over crafting the new fiscal year budget. At issue, how to spend on road projects, K-12 schools, and tax cuts.
Late last week, Governor Walker tried to break the budget stalemate with a compromise proposal on the transportation budget. His plan sought to boost federal spending and borrow less on road projects.
Sean Johnson is WPR's Capital Bureau Chief, and he's been covering this budget battle. Sean, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, July 1st, it came, it went for the new fiscal year budget. What do we know about budget negotiations at this point?
We know we still don't have one, and that in Wisconsin, there's not the same pressure that other states have to come to a deal once you pass that deadline, because the deadline doesn't mean as much here. There's what happens here is that government continues to be funded at the same levels it was funded under the old budget. So, you know, certainly areas that are hoping, expecting to get new spending under what the governor proposed for the next couple of years are watching this pretty closely. But they're not stopping. You know, there's not a stoppage of state government or the services that it supports.
There's certainly been a range of ways people have liked to stop the stalemate. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss had proposed this per mile fee on heavy trucks to chip away at the $1 billion state roads deficit, and it got struck down. And now Voss is challenging business groups to come up with an alternative. What's the response been?
Yeah, so the responses to that are still trickling in, and you know, this is for the transportation piece of the budget. You know, we have also the budget for schools still hasn't been passed. I mean, the legislature's budget committee has said they're pretty close on that or on the same page on that, but they haven't come together on that quite yet. When it comes to transportation, Voss had said earlier that this per mile fee on trucking, which could be something that resolved the budget, $138 million per year, it could have brought in, and it would have been assessed on the heaviest vehicles on the road, those vehicles that damage the road the most. But a pretty broad coalition of businesses and business groups said they don't want that. And so what Voss has done is said, okay, if you don't want that, what do you want? So far, we know that Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce has said, you know, we want you to cut costs at the Department of Transportation in a variety of ways. You know, but they did say they were, their board supports raising the gas tax by 5 cents or raising the vehicle registration fee by $25 per vehicle. But they say that's not politically tenable right now because the governor and Senate Republicans don't want to do that.
Well, why aren't they on the same page here? Because you'd think Republicans would, they control the two caucuses, that they should have more consensus in the party.
And yes, this is their fourth budget together, I believe, and since they took over state government in 2011. And so I think, you know, part of it potentially is that they've been through this before. And there's no, like, there hasn't been a serious, I guess, threat to them losing that power since they've taken that power. And so they're taking the time that they want to this time around. I think the transportation issue has gotten pretty serious. I mean, the more years that it's gotten delayed, a long-term fix to transportation, the more difficult it's become. And so you did see a couple years ago, the budget went past that July 1st deadline, and it was because of transportation. You're seeing that again with some pretty starkly different views on transportation between Republicans, and those, it's just, there's just not much middle ground between, you know, what they want to do.
We're talking right now with Sean Johnson. He's WPR's Capital Bureau Chief, and he's been covering the play-by-play here on this budget battle as we look to getting a new state budget crafted, although the deadline was July 1st for the fiscal year. And Sean, Governor Walker came out with an idea late last week to break the impasse with an option to solve transportation piece of the puzzle. What do we know about the governor's solution?
What the governor talked about doing would be reducing borrowing from what he proposed in his budget by $200 million. So he proposed $500 million in new borrowing. He proposed knocking that down to $300 million. And then having any additional borrowing contingent upon receiving more federal funding. And he just said in a letter to legislative leaders, Wisconsin is well positioned to qualify for additional federal funding to help support mega projects like the Zoo Interchange or I-94 North-South around Milwaukee. So that's what the governor proposed. It's a little tricky, though, because he framed it as a win for Assembly Republicans who want to reduce borrowing over the long term. And, he framed this idea of pursuing more federal funding as something that everybody could support. But if you borrow less as a state, you're also spending less as a state. I mean, they are going to have the potential that you build less as a state. And that's something that a lot of Republicans want to do, is build and continue building some of these mega projects in southeast Wisconsin. The other issue is he's relying on federal funding here. And that's no sure thing. And also, it's something that the governor has, when it comes to other areas of state funding, funding like Medicaid expansion or a high-speed rail link between Madison and Milwaukee, he's been less eager to take that for federal funding, even rejecting it.
Well, let's focus on a couple projects here. The Zoo Interchange project, the I-94 south of Milwaukee project. What could happen to these transportation projects if a budget isn't passed?
It'll be a few months before you really started to notice it. I mean, I think there would be some small effects after a month, according to this memo that came out from the legislature's budget office. The construction of a detention pond, for example, and the Zoo Interchange project would be delayed after a month. This Ryan Road interchange along I-94 North-South would be potentially delayed after a month. So those would be sort of the early warning signs that things aren't going to move as quickly as possible, as they should or could if the budget were approved. Beyond that, though, it would be a few months before you'd start to see more effects. So those would be some of the early signs. But because they're not huge and they don't kick in right away, it's not necessarily something that's going to bring lawmakers to the table.
What about local governments and schools? How might they be impacted or watching the situation unfold?
Schools have in the past been, that motivating factor that gets the parties to the table when budget negotiations drag on. So like in 2007, the legislature was under split party control back then, so it was a much different situation. But budget negotiations went on for many months, and it was in October sometime when they finally came together and agreed on a budget, because schools had to pass their budget, and they were waiting on that, that certainty of how much money they're going to get from the state, so they know what they can ask for from property taxpayers. So, that'd be a few months down the road. I'm not sure that anybody's saying that the school's budget is going to drag on that long, because Republicans are relatively close. They seem pretty far apart in this transportation stuff, though.
And the governor's spokesman said Friday that the governor presented his budget 5 months ago and is urging the legislature to complete its work. It sounds like the Walker administration might be getting a bit antsy on this.
He has said, the governor has said, he's going to wait to introduce his, or announce, I guess, formally that he's running for re-election until after the budget is passed. So, every day that drags on is another day that he can't do that. Then again, he can raise money and he can essentially campaign for that third term that everybody's expecting him to formally announce for while that's ongoing. So I'm not sure that that he's too antsy in that regard. It's not great for him to have this drag on too long, because they're haggling over a problem perceived problem that the state has. I mean, Assembly Republicans feel like debt has grown too much under Governor Walker, and they're not afraid to say so. And so the more months that this goes on, it's not exactly on message with what the governor wants to be talking about.
Yeah, because wouldn't Governor Walker be concerned with the image that the Republican Party is sending by not being able to agree on spending and how much debt is okay?
And I think that's something that Democrats have seized on. I mean, every day that the state's without a budget, they've been pointing that out, that we have this big impasse in Wisconsin. Republicans can't work together. if Republicans come together in the next few months and pass a budget, I'm not sure voters would remember the process a year and a half from now. They probably would remember or probably focus on the product. But it's definitely something that, you know, where Democrats, because they don't have power to change the final product by numbers, they're definitely trying to put some pressure on their GOP colleagues.
Sean, thanks so much for the update.
You're welcome.
That was Sean Johnson, WPR's State Capitol Bureau Chief. He was here to discuss the state budget and the sticking points that lawmakers are trying to work through in order to pass a new budget.
Right now, new research in paleoanthropology is challenging what we thought we knew about human evolution. There have been a number of studies over the last few years chipping away at the idea that anatomically modern humans, people more or less like us, evolved 100,000 years ago and left Africa about 60,000 years ago.
Gemma Tarlak joins us now. She's a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us about once a month to share science news. Gemma, welcome back to Central Time.
Hello, my friends and fellow science lovers.
Well, start us off with the backstory here, because there was the previously accepted notion of human evolution before this whole series of studies started coming out.
Yeah, this has been a really interesting, no pun intended, evolution to watch take place in the academic world. Because, you know, when I went to school, when I started working at Discover, the conventional timeline was, hey, humans, in terms of Homo sapiens, now we're not talking about Neanderthals or anybody else, but just Homo sapiens, evolved around 200,000 years ago and in a very early primitive form, and anatomically modern humans, as Rob mentioned, really came around on the evolutionary charts about 100,000 years ago. And we stayed in Africa, which was our homeland, until about maybe 60,000, 50,000 years ago. Then we spread out into Eurasia. And that has been, seriously, for years, the conventional timeline. That's what everyone learned, and that's what all the books said. But really, about 10 years ago, these studies started emerging, just kind of hinting like, well, we found this skull in Israel, and it doesn't look like a Neanderthal, and it doesn't look like a human, but it might be an early Homo sapien. And they're like, no, it's much too old. So little things started kind of like nibbling at the edges. And I think this year, even though the year is half over, this year is really going to turn into the year that the human evolution timeline gets completely rewritten and our species' birthday, as it were, gets pushed way back.
And it seems like, and you blogged about this one of the big sites that pushing that date back is called Jabal Erhoud. Where is this site, first of all?
Yeah, this is in a corner of Morocco, and you know, traditionally, Morocco is not really a hotspot for super early hominins. Those are mostly in East Africa, especially Ethiopia, and some in South Africa. So to find multiple early hominins at this one site in Morocco is very exciting. They found a couple adults, an adolescent, and also a child. So it wasn't just, you know, one random fossil. It was clearly a community, or at least a group, that was passing through that area. And in June, they released a couple papers looking at both the dating and just anatomically what these early hominins look like. And they're actually confirmed to be Homo sapiens. And the dating is what is really the jaw-dropping fact. They are 300,000 years old. So 300,000 years ago, we've got Homo sapiens. Remember, we thought the super early primitive form of Homo sapiens was around maybe 200,000 years ago, but oops, nope, sorry, we were off by 100,000 years at least. So that in itself is super exciting.
And Gemma, we can rely on that this dating is correct.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because dating is always a prime concern when you're looking at paleoanthropological finds, and they used a couple different methods. The methods themselves are kind of difficult to describe in 10 words or less, but these are some of the most refined methods of thermoluminescence dating and such that they can really nail things down definitively, and they were able to do that here in a very, what researchers call, robust manner. So they have a lot of confidence in these dates, and even the researchers were saying, we had no idea we were going to get these dates. This is nuts, but we're so excited about it. This is the earliest known population of Homo sapiens, so that is just amazing.
And it was interesting, this study at Jabal Erhoud in North Africa, they were just kind of looking back over stuff they'd kind of looked at before, right? This was a lucky discovery in some ways.
Yeah, it is. You know, it's a fascinating sight how it just came to light, because I think in the mid-50s or 60s, it was actually a quarry site. And they found some bones, just some of the miners, you know, found bones and turned them over to a friend who turned them over to a friend. Eventually, they ended up in the hands of someone who knew what they were looking at. And this team went back, starting in about 2004, this team of paleoanthropologists went back to the site in hopes of dating those earlier remains that had been found kind of willy-nilly in the 50s and 60s. And they realized there was an area of the site that had not been touched by mining. It had not been excavated. It was undisturbed. So that's where they started digging, and that's where they started finding these things. And then, of course, once they found all these fossils, then they spent years dating them and double-checking the dating and refining the dating method. And it was just in June that they came out saying, yep, Homo sapiens, 300,000 years old. Surprise!
We're talking right now with Gemma Tarlak. She's senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. And some new research out challenging what we thought we knew about human evolution and when it happened. Gemma, there's also been a study published in Nature that came out in April. It was centered on a partial mastodon skeleton discovered near San Diego. And this particular skull looked to have been processed by some kind of hominin. How does this challenge our ideas about human evolution?
Well, this is an interesting study for a different reason, in that this study, I have to say up front, has been highly controversial. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of people who in the field who are saying, no, we don't want to put any weight in this study. But in light of all these other studies coming out changing the chronology, this one I think deserves a second look. And here's why. They found a 130,000-year-old mastodon outside San Diego. And again, they dated it, so the date's confirmed. And there were just a couple weird things about the fossil when they found it. The way it was arranged, and also some of the marks on the bones, some of the way the bones had been broken. And then also they found these really weird rocks right at the site. They were not typical of rocks in the area, and they appeared to look like very primitive cobbles or stone tools used for kind of smashing and bashing before our species got really good at making stone tools. And the folks investigating this site, or I should say reinvestigating the artifacts found at the site, because the actual artifacts were found back in 94, the folks coming back and redating the site and looking at it with a closer eye concluded that these cobblestones were used by some kind of hominin to process the mastodon. There's no evidence that they butchered it. There's no evidence that they killed it. But they think these stones were used to kind of smash and bash the bones in a way to get the marrow, which is, of course, super nutritious. The problem is, of course, 130,000 years ago, we don't have any reason to believe there were any hominins in the Americas. The conventional timeline, which, again, is getting shakier all over this year, but the conventional timeline for humans being in the Americas is only about 15,000 years. Some researchers will push that back to maybe 18,000, maybe 20,000, but it is nowhere near 130,000. But the team, however, that is looking at these mastodon bones and looking at these alleged cobbles said, wait a minute, 130,000 years ago, the land bridge between Siberia and Alaska, called Beringia, that land bridge was high and dry. That's how bison came over from Europe and came into the Americas. Hey, who likes to hunt bison? Early hominins. Is it not possible that maybe Neanderthals or Denisovans, close cousins of ours like the Neanderthals, or even these super early Homo sapiens came over on that land bridge and stopped in San Diego? Again, this is a lot. You have to kind of jump through a lot of hoops to reach that conclusion. So I would say most researchers in the field are like, no. But it's just tantalizing to see all these things bubbling up that suggest our timeline may be really off. So I think that the whole mastodon processing site, that idea is a little more less implausible, if I could say that, than it was before we found all these other much older Homo sapiens that tell us our timeline is off.
So these stories we've talked about so far have been about when did modern Homo sapiens evolve and when did different types of humans or prehumans move around the world. Let's move to another one now. Our relationship, modern humans' relationship with Neanderthals, turns out we may have been mixing back and forth, breeding back and forth earlier than we thought.
Yes, and I believe the scientific term is hanky-panky. Anyway, but
in the Latin.
We've known for a few years now that when Homo sapiens moved into Europe, according to the conventional timeline, 50, 60,000 years ago, that there were episodes of interbreeding with Neanderthals. And there were a few of them, quite frankly. And there is also some evidence of interbreeding between Homo sapiens and the Denisovans, who are, again, kind of our cousins along with the Neanderthals. But recently, they took a look at this thigh bone that came out of a cave in Germany in the 1930s, and researchers took a second look at it and applied 21st century methods to it to extract some DNA. And this is specifically, it's called mitochondrial DNA, and that's the maternally inherited stuff. So mitochondrial DNA, it's problematic because it only tells you half of the story, but it's easier to get than nuclear DNA, which comes from inside the nucleus of the cell and is much easier to tell you the whole story of that individual's past. But they took this mitochondrial DNA and they found that it's actually very close to ancient Homo sapiens. And they did a little more looking around, a little more comparing with both other archaic and modern humans and also just, you know, plain old modern humans walking around today, not just in the fossil record. And they found evidence that this particular individual was descended from a Neanderthal father and a Homo sapiens mother who interbred about 220,000 years ago. Again, there's that timeline that we thought until, you know, this year, Homo sapiens weren't even around until 200,000 years ago. Now they were already interbreeding outside Africa with Neanderthals 220,000 years ago. So, again, chipping away, I wouldn't even say chipping away, I would say taking a sledgehammer to that conventional timeline.
Lots of blurred lines between species. Gemma, thanks a lot for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
That's Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joined us to dig into some recent studies challenging the timeline of human evolution. Recent news stories have highlighted changes in the auto industry, both in terms of manufacturing and the market. Some car makers are moving away, some pretty quickly, from the standard gasoline-fueled combustion engine that's been the norm, which is creating some pressure on their competitors, too.
And that pressure could be even more intense as countries think about requiring higher efficiency and lower emissions for vehicles sold to their residents. France, for example, is set to ban sales of gasoline and diesel cars by 2040.
Michelle Krebs is a Detroit-based executive analyst for Auto Trader, a Cox automotive company, along with Kelly Blue Book. She spent 35 years covering and observing the auto industry as a journalist and auto analyst. Michelle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
Well, what long-term trend, how quickly are non-gasoline cars rising in the United States?
Not that quickly, actually. We will have gasoline engines for a good long time, but we are seeing automakers and governments regulate more emission-free or low-emission vehicles going forward. So what we are seeing is automakers are introducing electric vehicles or what we call electrified vehicles, that is hybrids, plug-in hybrids, or vehicles with gasoline engines but that have some electric systems that help them get better fuel economy and lower emissions. We're a long ways off from all vehicles across the globe being electric vehicles, but we're moving in that direction over time.
A few years back, gas was really, really expensive, and people thought that was going to hasten the trend. Now gas is much cheaper than it was. How much of a difference has that made?
It's made some difference. Certainly, gasoline is very cheap. That makes it very competitive against electric vehicles. But the other thing that's happened, and I think it's not well recognized, is automotive engineers have done an amazing job of making gasoline engines far more fuel efficient. For example, today's sport utility vehicles that are so popular and trucks are not the vehicles, are not the same as the ones 10 years ago. They get far better fuel economy. In fact, some of them get almost as good fuel economy as their counterpart that's a car. That's why sport utility vehicles are so popular. So that is a factor. The other thing is, you know, we don't have a full infrastructure on charging. You know, you and I are used to just pulling into a gas station, topping it off. You can't do that everywhere with an electric vehicle. So we're a ways away from that.
And who are some of the big players who are trying to push, manufacturers now, who are trying to push alternatively fueled cars, the electrified cars you were talking about?
Well, Tesla, of course, is an all-electric vehicle company, and this is a significant week for Tesla because it is introducing the Model 3, which is their most mainstream vehicle. It's priced somewhere in the 30, low 40s. They've already got almost 400,000 orders. People plunked down $1,000 for deposits before they were even made. So that is will be a very significant step, and it will be. I think that will be a good test case for how well electric vehicles will do. Volvo just announced last week and caused all kinds of hubbub that it was launching five fully electric models between 2019 and 2021 and a range of hybrid models. Now, we have to remember hybrids also have a gasoline engine as well as electric motors and batteries. But Volvo is now owned by a Chinese auto company called Geely. And, of course, China's got terrible air pollution problems, and so they have been really looking at pushing electric vehicles to help with that problem.
I want to key in on Tesla for a minute. I saw a news story, I think it was just last week, that kind of surprised me. General Motors had just become, again, the top-valued automaker, beating out Tesla. And so Tesla had the highest market valuation of any auto company, but they don't make a lot of autos compared to a company like General Motors and the other big names.
No, and they don't make any money compared to General Motors.
Right. What's driving that huge valuation?
It's crazy. I can't even begin to explain the stock market, except that Wall Street always has looked at, until just recently, has always looked at Tesla as being this technology, Silicon Valley technology company, and General Motors and Ford as these, you know, heavy manufacturing auto companies. Neither description is apt for both of them. They're a mixture of both. GM and Ford are very high-tech companies. In fact, General Motors introduced the Chevrolet Bolt, an electric vehicle that gets the biggest range of any electric car at 238 miles, and Tesla builds vehicles, so it is also a manufacturing company. So the Wall Street has always looked at them kind of oddly, and you know, GM and Ford have had record profits in recent years. Tesla has yet to turn a profit and is burning through a lot of cash. So it's always baffled me how the market looks at the two companies differently.
Michelle Krebs is with us from Auto Trader, looking at big changes maybe in the works in the auto industry. Michelle, staying with that point of the blurred lines between automakers and high-tech companies that we've heard, you know, Google trying to get into self-driving cars, maybe Apple, other big Silicon Valley names. How important a factor are they going to be in either, I don't know, getting into the auto industry themselves or partnering with existing auto manufacturers?
That's a huge shift. Always before, it was just the auto companies competing against each other. But now we've got technology companies getting into the game. However, what I have seen, and Google's been working on autonomous vehicles for quite some time. We believe Apple has as well. But I think one of the things that they've discovered is, maybe we don't want to actually build the vehicles ourselves. Let's let the experts in Detroit and Munich and Tokyo do that, and we'll partner with them. That's kind of the approach Google has taken. They just put their systems into a number of Chrysler Pacifica minivans. I think they've got 100 out there. They're adding more. Apple's very quiet. We know they're up to something, but we don't know exactly what.
How much is the auto market driven by places other than the United States? You mentioned some countries looking to control emissions, places like China, I think India, wanting more alternative energy types of cars. How much is what's happening in those huge countries going to affect what's available to us on the market in the United States?
Well, China is the big one. China is the biggest car market in the world. I think they sell something like 28 million new cars a year. We sell at record levels at just under 18 million. So they are a huge player. And everybody's always said, When China goes all electric, that will be the tipping point, because the economies of scale will be there and it'll just shift the dynamic. So China's the one to watch. But there are many other places. London and Paris are looking at how do we have electric vehicles, maybe autonomous vehicles in the city centers, mainly because of the congestion. There's work going on all around the globe. And I think the real key will be when you have autonomous vehicles that are electric and that they're also connected with each other, which is way down the line, but that's the vision for the future.
As I understand it, one big stumbling block still for fully electric cars is trying to develop that battery that's reliable, that gives us the long range. What is the race for the perfect battery like right now?
Well, yeah, we've come a long way, but there's still work to be done on batteries. They're pretty heavy and bulky. What everybody's looking at is how do you get more power into smaller batteries and get the cost down. So that's where a lot of the work is going on. As I mentioned before, General Motors made a big breakthrough with the Chevrolet Bolt that is now gets 238 miles on a charge. I'm hearing from my colleagues it actually does better than that. So that's a big step. But, the batteries are kind of bulky.
And how about price point right now? Electric cars came onto the market, more expensive. Hybrids, kind of a price premium there. How do gasoline and diesel cars compare to those hybrids and electrics?
Well, electric cars, like the Chevrolet Bolt, is in the $30,000-ish. The Tesla Model 3 is in that $30,000-$35,000 range, and that's where it needs to be, because the average vehicle cost in America is $35,000. Now, that's because we buy a lot of sport utilities, which are a little pricier, but to really spread to the mainstream, it needs to be kind of in that $30,000, $35,000, $40,000 price range.
And you mentioned that in the United States, at least, we love driving SUVs or something in that neighborhood. What are we seeing in terms of electric and hybrid options for SUVs?
There are some, and Tesla came out with the Model X, which is a sport utility vehicle. I don't know if it's done as well as they'd hoped. They've had some quality issues with things like the doors, not so much the electric systems. But I think that will be, we'll see more of that. There certainly are a number of hybrids in that category. So, but we're used to hybrids. They've been around for a long time.
We're talking to Michelle Krebs. She's a Detroit-based executive analyst for Auto Trader.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you excited about the auto industry moving toward more green technology? If those more environmentally friendly options cost more, are you willing to pay for them? And do you think that the U.S. government should offer incentives for people who buy more eco-friendly cars? Join in 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about the evolution of the auto industry and what it might mean for U.S. car manufacturers and drivers. Michelle Krebs is with us. She's a Detroit-based executive analyst for Auto Trader.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. How are autos changing for you? Have you considered or bought a hybrid or electric vehicle? Would you buy them if the price inched down a little bit more? Do you think there should be more government support or more government mandates for more fuel-efficient cars, whatever the fuel might be? Are you segueing out of automobiles, relying on car sharing, if that's an option where you live? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And that, Michelle, is another part of the story lately. People paying a lot of attention to companies like Uber with problems of their own, and Lyft and others where you use the app to get somebody to come and pick you up. Are we seeing a segment of Americans, especially younger Americans, move away from owning their car at all?
Well, the car and ride-sharing services certainly give them an option. And we know that the younger generation has had you know, slow to get into the new car market because they were hit with the recession so hard and big college loans and stuff. So it's buying a new car is tough for them. So that has filled in a gap. We did a study, Kelly Blue Book did a study some time ago that we looked at the biggest users of car sharing, ride sharing, of course, were urban millennials. But interestingly, they were also the group that most wanted to own a car of their own because they wanted that, saw that as their personal freedom, whereas Uber, Lyft, and other services like that were there for specific purposes, parking situations or going to the bar, or that kind of thing. So they don't view it as either or. They view it as both. And we think maybe going forward, you'll see how young people forming households, and they'll maybe buy one car, but maybe they'll fill in with car sharing and ride sharing for that what would have been a second car for a baby boomer home, for example.
Let's bring in our callers now at 800-642-1234. Brian is with us in Milwaukee. Brian, hi.
Hi. I'm just calling to tell you I just got my second Toyota hybrid car, not a Prius, but another model. And I had the one before this for 9 years, and I expect to keep this one for 10 years. And that's getting the most amazing mileage, and I love it.
And Brian, what motivated you to do that? Was it environmental interest or saving money on gas, or what led you to make that decision?
Well, I think for the most part environmental, but on the other hand, gas is so cheap now, it's not really saving all that much the difference. When I first got my first hybrid, it was about twice as much as it is now, almost. So, but I'm still very pleased. It is averaging, as I'm sitting here watching it, for the average mileage I've been getting is nearly 50 miles to the gallon.
Brian, thanks a lot for that call. Michelle, is there something, do consumers watch the price of gasoline that closely? Is that a big motivator to lead people to say, yeah, okay, I'll spend a little extra for that hybrid or electric?
Well, see, you know, Brian brings up a good point. That was the case. I remember when the lead up to the spring of 2008, prices of gas really shot up, and we saw some shift in what people bought. The problem is, you know, for hybrids and electric vehicles now, the price of gas is so low that the premiums on hybrids and such the payoff takes a long time. Although, I will say this, if you want a good deal, some of the best deals are on hybrid vehicles. They're being very heavily discounted because gas prices are low and consumers are opting for something else, so check out a hybrid.
Brian, thanks for that call. Barbara joins us next in Delafield. Barbara, hi.
Hi. I just bought a new hybrid, a Kia Niro, and I wanted to buy an American car, as I did the last time I was looking for a car. Last time I had an American car, it was a 93 Ford Escort that got me 36 miles to a gallon. I happen to be very conscientious about the global warming and climate change and all that. And I have 6 grandkids that I want to be able to breathe someday and their children. So, to me, this whole thing is unbelievable that the United States is not making more hybrids and selling them. I want to support our country. I try to buy Made in America, and yet I can't if I'm looking at something like climate change and the environment. It's so ridiculous. I wish to God people would get their act together and give us what we need.
Barbara, thanks a lot for the call. Michelle, are there a lot of consumers out there in the same boat thinking, I'd like to buy an American-made hybrid, but not seeing competitive alternatives that they want?
Well, you know, they're out there, and people haven't bought them. So, you know, Ford, for example, has a Fusion hybrid. It doesn't sell all that well. Its Lincoln division decided to sell a gasoline version of hybrid at the same price, and still the gasoline engine won out. So, you know, it's not just that they aren't making them. Believe me, if you see, they're out there. They're sitting on lots. They're high inventories of hybrids, and they're being heavily discounted. Americans just are not buying them that much.
Barbara, thanks for the call. Go next to Tom in Spencer. Tom, hi.
Hi. I want to thank Michelle for Auto Trader. First of all, I picked out my last 4 vehicles from Auto Trader before.
Yay! I'm happy to hear that.
A wonderful, wonderful website. Thank you. And then I want to say my wife and I just bought a 2015 Mustang GT.
Well, that's not a hybrid.
Miles on it. No, it had 8,000 miles on it. It's like new, and it gets 0 to 60 in 4.5 seconds. Cost us $30,000. Which would you rather have?
Tom, thanks for the call.
You're a diehard.
Tom, thanks for the call. I don't have the numbers in front of me. I'm guessing that Mustang GT doesn't have the gas mileage of your average hybrid, Michelle.
No, it does not. No, it does not.
But Tom is not alone. A lot of people not as worried about the gas mileage on a car, especially, again, since gas prices have come down.
Right. I mean, I hate to say this, but the best thing that could happen for hybrids and electric vehicles are if you know, gas prices shot way up. And we saw that in 2008. They shot up unexpectedly. People shifted their buying patterns. But now they've come back down to a level that they're very low and affordable. And fuel economy has fallen down the list of priorities for car buyers.
Tom, thanks for the call as we talk to Michelle Krebs from Auto Trader, looking at trends in the auto industry, in part hybrid and electric cars slowly growing in the United States, maybe some bigger changes to come. Brett joins us next in Wauwatosa. Brett, hi.
Yeah, hi. My question is, everyone talks about CO emissions once we drive the car, which the electric car obviously will be a lot lower than conventional gas car. But what about in building it? Because, like, the electrical cars, they require the lead in it, the smelting, the
lithium ion. Mm-hmm.
Right, and all of that versus, and two, even having lighter materials that cost more. So the CO for building that versus building a conventional car, what's the CO emissions difference just building them?
Brad,
so
thanks for the call.
Yeah, we call that weld a wheel. You can find different studies depending on your point of view. And it also depends on where, if you have an electric car, where you get your electricity from. If you're getting it from a coal-burning electric plant, that may not be the greatest. Great controversy in that. I think ultimately hybrids went out, but on the well to wheel. But I'm not sure. I've seen various studies on that.
Brett, thanks a lot for the call, Michelle. I wanted to ask about U.S. Fuel economy standards. How much have those affected the cars available on the market now? What kind of changes are we watching for?
Well, under the Obama administration, there were very stringent fuel economy standards put in for 2025 for trucks and cars, and there was supposed to be a midterm review between 2017 and 2018, and the Trump administration, when the Obama administration was going out of office, they said, we're moving along in a good direction, we don't need to have that midterm review. The Trump administration has put that midterm review back in. We think rightly so, because we felt like that was part of the deal. And so there will be a review, and they'll decide where they go with the standards by April 1 of 2018. There's a lot of fear by environmentalists that they'll roll back those standards. I think one of the issues that we talked about here that has to be addressed is, how do you generate consumer demand for more fuel-efficient, low-emissions vehicles? So I think that should be the main issue on the table.
We'll leave it there for now. Michelle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Michelle Krebs. She's a Detroit-based executive analyst for Auto Trailer. That's a Cox Automotive company, along with Kelly Blue Book. She joined us today to talk about the move toward vehicles, the slow move in some cases toward vehicles powered by alternative fuels, along with some other trends in the auto industry. Still time for you to share your thoughts and your experiences with alternative fuels, hybrid or electric vehicles. Have you gotten one? Do you not want one? Would you get one if they were cheaper? But also, have you used one of the so-called car sharing services in your hometown, or maybe when you're out traveling, the Ubers and the Lyfts? And if and when self-driving cars become available, would you trust your car to drive you? Let us know on the Central Time Facebook page.
In Wisconsin, people talk about up north for vacation, especially in the summer. But what does up north mean? What's the dividing line?
The answer is different for different people. A new project from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel lets people draw their own line for up north. It's a survey that lets you draw a line across the state where you think up north starts.
And still in an older poll, the Journal Sentinel let people define up north by selecting one of six highways as the dividing line. The winner was Highway 8, running from Barron through Tomahawk, with second place going to Highway 2, even farther north.
Those are the two northernmost options. But with a new poll, people can make the line as curvy as they want. Now, our Michelle Good here is from Minocqua. By that Highway 8 standard, Minocqua's up north, right? Do you consider Minocqua up north? She's off mic, but she is nodding. I don't know. You're newer to our state, Kate.
I always thought up north depended on what state you're in. I thought up north meant northern Minnesota because I'd only heard up north in Minnesota.
Okay. But you don't have a working definition for up north in Wisconsin.
I have yet to have a working definition of up north in Wisconsin. Still working on that.
And maybe our Illinois listeners, the line is drawn through Beloit. Let us know, and you can participate. You can draw your own line. There's a link on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to the Ideas Network.